WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Homer's The Odyssey has been around for more than 2,000 years, and it keeps getting retranslated and updated. The latest is by Princeton University professor Robert Fagles, who has said every generation needs a new translation of Homer. The Odyssey tells the story of Odysseus's 10-year voyage home to Ithaca following the Trojan War. Along the way, he has to deal with obstacles that try his moral endurance and test his survival skills. The Odyssey has a revered place in the literary canon, but for all the reverence about it, it's also a great adventure love story and explores the very contemporary theme of a son in search of his long-lost father. Robert Fagles translated Homer's other epic tale, The Iliad, in 1990. I asked him when translating something as important as The Iliad or The Odyssey, how much he has to be true to the original Greek, and how much liberty he thinks he's entitled to take with the text.
Let me just say something about how one goes about the work. On the one hand, there's the Greek text and the commentaries and the lexicons, and you try and master as much of that as you can. And on the other hand, there are the great things of 20th century writing, too. In other words, I try to stay as close to Homer's Odyssey as I do to James Joyce's Ulysses. The two are of almost equal importance, because the whole problem is, how do I try to capture that great piece of work, some 2,700 years old, and bring it over into an English that is molded by some real masters and mistresses?
Right.
And that becomes the problem. How do you bring these two things together, the language which we're speaking now and the language which Homer spoke way back when? That's, I think, the problem, and it's a two-way street. I'm always asking myself, if Homer were living in the 90s, how would he say this or that or the other thing? It's a two-way street because if Homer were living in the 90s, he might not say this or that or the other thing. So bringing him into my own idiom is a kind of limitation. Mm. On the other hand, Homer is so large that he can give my idiom a good stretching. That's why I describe it as a back and forth, a two-way street.
Is it helpful to think of the Odyssey as a kind of performance, or as you say in the postscript to the book, a musical event? And does that help you find the rhythm of his language and to take that language and modernize it?
I think, if this doesn't sound like too, it isn't a claim for my own work, it's just a notion. If an English Homer doesn't sing, it's not a Homer. There has to be some verbal music in it, and that's established by what you do with the weave of the vowels, what you do with the cadence of your English. At the same time, it has to be a vehicle for many kinds of speech. There's another kind of performance. The Odyssey is 70% direct discourse. Uh-huh. Characters are talking all over the place, and they're talking in different ways, and they're talking to each other, at each other, with each other. In other words, within a great epic structure, it's a dramatic piece, mm-hmm. very dramatic. So that's part of the performance, too, and something I think you have to try and conquer.
Well, do you work out loud, then?
All the time, and that's why I work within closed doors, because otherwise I might get locked up.
Well, you brought some Greek for
us,
and perhaps we can just hear the Greek, and then I'd like to have you read from the beginning of your translation.
I'd love to. This is the way the poem begins. It's the invocation. Andromoia nepomusa, polutropon hos malapola, plangthea pei troies, hieron ptoliethrona persa, polon danthropon, iren astia kai noan egno, polidogen panto, pathanalgia hon katathumon, arnumenos hente, psuchein kai nostonatairon, alutos et arus, erusito hiemenos per, Auton garas veteresin, atasthaliesin alonto, nepioi, hoi katabus, huperionos eelioio, aestheon, autaratoisin, aphaleton ostimon amar, ton hamathengathea thugeterdios, apa kai hemen. Which means something like this in English. Sing to me of the man, muse, the man of twists and turns, driven time and again off course. Once he had plundered the hallowed heights of Troy. Many cities of men he saw and learned their minds. Many pains he suffered, heart sick on the open sea, fighting to save his life and bring his comrades home. But he could not save them from disaster, hard as he strove, The recklessness of their own ways destroyed them all, the blind fools. They devoured the cattle of the sun, and the sun god blotted out the day of their return. Launch out on his story, Muse, daughter of Zeus. Start from where you will. Sing for our time, too.
And that's Robert Fagles reading from the beginning of his translation of Homer's The Odyssey. Well, I wonder, too, and hearing the Greek and then hearing your translation of it, the rhythm feels different to me.
You have
done something to the rhythm.
Sure.
Tell us what you've done.
Well, what I've done is, first of all, I've decided that I cannot imitate Homeric hexameters, dactylic hexameters. They don't really work in English, I find, and I've never read comparable hexameters in English that do work.
And a hexameter, just for those
a six-beat line.
Okay.
Which goes something like this, Andromoi en nepomusa polutropon hos malapolla. That's Homer's wonderful rolling six-beat line. I try and make my English elastic. I don't want to write an iambic pentameter, a straight five-beat line, because I don't want to domesticate Homer too much. I want him to be at home in my language, but not too much. He's larger, he's stranger, he's more powerful. So I've tried to expand a typical English line, often going to six beats, occasionally to seven, and always trying, if possible, to get that line cadenced, make it music in some way, give it a beat, give it a rhythm. It's a kind of free verse, but I have my own kinds of rules, I hope. I hope it won't sound as if it's, what did Frost describe? How did he describe free verse? As playing tennis without a net.
Our guest is Robert Fagles, and we're talking about his new translation of Homer's The Odyssey. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Princeton University literature professor Robert Fagles and his new translation of Homer's The Odyssey. What's the difference, or what was the different challenge between translating the Iliad, which came out about five, six, 7 years ago, and now the Odyssey?
The Iliad is set at a very high pitch. You begin to roll with it, and it simply won't stop. It's got a terrific pace to it, and one of the questions you ask yourself when you're working on it, how can I keep this thing from sagging? How can I keep up the momentum, the speed, often the violence? Though it's a poem that has some tenderness, too. But the Odyssey has a great deal of tenderness and a great deal of variety of mood, from outspoken outburst to calm, sotto voce speech like this. And you have to capture that kind of tone. You have to capture that great variety. So moving away from the Iliad, set almost at one level pitch, the Odyssey introduces you to a whole range of musics.
Well, I saw a reference to the Iliad as a kind of masculine tale, and the Odyssey as a more feminine or feminized story. Would you agree with that characterization?
I think there's quite a lot of truth in that, Marty. The only thing I would say is that the Iliad is a poem, as we often say, the poem about war. Yet it's a poem about much more than war. It's a poem about human mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an experience that Helen and Andromache and Thetis even experience just as well as men do. The Odyssey, I'm not sure that it's a feminized poem. I think it's a poem, it's the most married poem I know. And it's a poem in which men and women get equal time. And I think that's one of its great glories, great beauties, one of the things that drew me to it.
You believe that Homer was a real person, and other Homer scholars think that he might be an amalgam of people.
Yes.
Why do you think such a person existed?
Well, I have a hard time thinking of the Iliad and the Odyssey being composed by a committee. I think there's too much unity in these poems. And I'm, I guess, an incurable romantic, and I mean something specific by that. I'm committed to the notion of the large poetic imagination, the single poetic imagination that can move from the world of Troy to the world of Ithaca, the world of war to the world of post-war readjustment and ultimately peace. I like that notion. And even if it isn't true, and we may never know, it's a good convenience for the translator doing both poems, that you want the voice to be a kindred voice, just shifting his perspectives, his objectives.
And, of course, this began as a spoken story.
Spoken or maybe even sung. Homer has moments in the Odyssey where he describes what the performance was like, and there was some kind of stringed instrument that might have been strummed. And above all, Homer was playing his voice into the voices of dozens of other characters. He was the great ventriloquist, he must have been, or anyone named Homer was.
So it began as an oral tradition and then obviously has been written down over the ages by...
200-300 years after it was an oral performance, it became written down and was written down in many different forms for about 1,800 years. until the first printed version came along in 1488.
And I guess each written form, what, reflects the time and age, the person
who
wrote it
down?
Very
much so. It's subject to a lot of scribal error and scribal adaptation.
Well, I've actually pulled out several translations of the same passage, including yours. I wanted to read one by Robert Fitzgerald, and this goes back to 1961.
Yes.
And then you'll read your translation.
Fine.
And perhaps you can even just tell the audience before they hear this what they're going to hear.
All right. This is a passage from the fifth book of the Odyssey. Odysseus has been held captive by Calypso, whose name means to hide or to cover. He's been calypsoed on a beautiful island in the middle of the sea for at least 7 years. And finally, Zeus and Athena decide that he can be released. Before he goes, however, he has to come to terms with Calypso and her great offer. Her offer is that of immortality, which doesn't come easily in the Greek world any more than it does in ours. Nevertheless, he remains loyal to Penelope, and the immortality offered by Calypso is finally not a temptation. The great temptation, or the great objective, is to leave that island and head for home and become reunited with his wife.
This is a brief one,
in which Odysseus, in a very clear-sighted way, compares the immortal Calypso with the mortal Penelope and says his choice in a kind of declarative way.
All right, and this is Robert Fitzgerald's translation. This goes back to 1961. My lady goddess, here is no cause for anger. My quiet Penelope, how well I know, would seem a shade before your majesty, death and old age being unknown to you while she must die. Yet it is true each day I long for home, long for the sight of home. If any god has marked me out again for shipwreck, my tough heart can undergo it. What hardship have I not long since endured at sea, in battle? Let the trial come. Now as he spoke, the sun set, dusk drew on, and they retired, this pair, to the inner cave to revel and rest softly side by side.
It was nicely read, and it's a beautiful piece of work.
Yes,
Robert Fitzgerald was a great friend of mine and my wife's. I found myself more than once translating work that Robert translated many years ago, and I do so with trepidation. At any rate, here's my version of the passage. Ah, great goddess, worldly Odysseus answered, don't be angry with me, please. All that you say is true, how well I know. Look at my wives, Penelope. She falls far short of you. Your beauty, stature. She is mortal after all, and you never age or die. Nevertheless, I pine all my days to travel home and see the dawn of my return. And if a god will wreck me yet again on the wine-dark sea, I can bear that too, with a spirit tempered to endure. Much have I suffered, labored long and hard by now in the waves and wars. Add this to the total. Bring the trial on. Even as he spoke, the sun set and the darkness swept the earth. And now, withdrawing into the cavern's deep recesses, long in each other's arms, they lost themselves in love.
I want to ask you, because you said every generation needs a new translation of Homer, do you feel that those words speak to your, my, and perhaps our children's generation?
I hope so. It's very hard for me to measure that. Mm-hmm. Certainly that's my goal, as it is the goal of any translator, to speak to his or her time.
And to use the language, the vernacular, the rhythms of the time.
Yes, I do think so. At the same time, you're looking for a language that is timely on the one hand and timeless on the other. Homer manages to do that, and you're obligated, I think, to try and do the same hundreds of years after Homer and in your own language and in your own sweet way. You're obligated to try and do that, too, mix the timely and the timeless.
Well, since there's no third Homer, what's next for you, the translator?
I don't know, and it's a problem, to say the very least. And after spending about 20 years with Homer and finding that I wake up in the morning and, well, Homer's there, but he's not waiting to be translated by me much anymore, I have a sense of loss of comradeship.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is distracted from that weighty question by virtue of the fact that I'm a teacher and part of a university, and I give readings from the Odyssey, and there's much to do still. But where to turn after Homer, I really don't know. And it's a question that fills me with a lot of trepidation.
Robert Fagel's new translation of Homer's The Odyssey has just been published. He's a professor of comparative literature at Princeton University. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.